I have seen the best swimmers of my generation go under. I'm Don Swaim with Crosstalk. That little tease at the beginning of Crosstalk was written by John Barth, a kind of, a takeoff on Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and it deals with the effort of a sperm as it tries to swim its way to join an egg. Now, that sort of sense of humor may be outrageous to some, perhaps diabolical to others, perhaps just plain fun, depending on your perspective. John Barth is the National Award-winning author of Chimera, and is acclaimed for such early novels as The Floating Opera, The End of the Road, and The Sotweed Factor. His latest book is Sabbatical, which offers up a little of everything, including the simultaneous narration by both the principal characters. John Barth is professor of English and creative writing at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. And John Barth's critical acclaim is one thing, and being widely read is another. Have you ever felt that there might be some gap between you and your potential readers?
No doubt there is sometimes, and while critical acclaim is, as you say, one thing, and being widely read another, I'm sure that in the best of possible worlds, all novelists would prefer to have both. In the worst of possible worlds, a novelist has neither. But I think if I had to choose between the one or the other, I would very reluctantly choose to be praised by the small number of people whose judgment I respect than to have them not like what I'm doing, while many others do. But God knows one would rather be Dickens, finally, than be James Joyce, much as one admires.
Who precisely is your target audience?
I don't think about that nearly as much as I should. I heard a fellow writer whom I much admire, Donald Barthelme, say once in answer to that question, "She is 32 years old. She lives at such and such latitude and longitude. She has been divorced once but has a new good relationship." When I ask myself, who am I writing for? I suspect that it's some kind of imaginary reader who I hope exists, and if who doesn't, I'll have to imagine into existence.
I presume a reader who would not want to get sand between the pages of the book.
Well, you know, some serious stuff can be read on beaches. I've got nothing against beaches.
Your early novels were quite conventional in style, but Giles Goatboy was one of your books that changed all that. And it's about a young man fathered by a computer and raised as a goat.
Yes, it is.
And Letters was a very complex book that dumbfounded many of your critics. And, of course, Sabbatical is highly original. We'll have more to say about that in a few minutes. But you did move further and further away from literary constraints and conventions. How did this happen?
Well, or into a different kind of constraints and a different orchestration of conventions. Let's talk a minute about complexity, Don, because that's a subject about which I have deep feelings. It's a curious thing that in literature, I suppose in some of the other arts too, complexity is automatically regarded as some kind of vice, as some kind of liability to the enjoyment of a story. When in athletics, in many other kinds of things, in sports, in cooking, and so forth, complexity can be one of the delights. In many kinds of storytelling, it is, too. It's the phenomenon of modernism, I think, that's given complexity a bad name, and that's a shame, because, after all, primitive storytellers, folk poets and so forth, even children, delight in a kind of artful complication of their stories. That whole tradition of narratives that begins, "This is the house that Jack built," and then adds on that simple foundation complexity after complexity, until the trick is to see whether the child repeating it or the storyteller telling it can get all his chestnuts out of the fire with some sweeping bravura gesture at the end. That ought to be delightful. If complexity is forbidding, it's not because that's in the nature of complexity or in the nature of storytelling. It's because the author, the storyteller, hasn't done his job right. Complexity ought to be part of the charm of storytelling, as it can be part of the charm of life. Simplicity has its delights, no doubt. But God help us if we don't enjoy complex things.
But complexity also can lend itself to an intellectual workout, which is important, too, I think, in modern literature.
Quite so. And intellectual workouts, like any other kinds of workouts, any other kinds of gymnastics, can be exciting, too. But they're not the diet one wants all the time. On that, we're agreed. You had another question left.
Well, this was a deliberate moving away from where we're talking mostly, I think, about stylistic changes. And obviously, you moved away from The Floating Opera and The End of the Road, which were fairly straight novels into offbeat, almost bizarre presentations. And obviously you did this very deliberately.
Indeed so. It was a quite deliberate decision. I'd written those two fairly short, fairly realistic, fairly simple novels, both of which it gives me pleasure to remember. And then partly, I suppose, out of any performer's impulse not to do the same thing again, but to try to set the bar a little higher on the high jump and see if you can still clear it with some degree of energy, humor, passion, grace. That, combined with the 17 other reasons that every artist has for doing everything, led me to rediscover the 18th century, the wonderfully complicated, rambunctious, not very orderly novels of Fielding, novels such as Tom Jones and so forth. I felt when I reread Fielding, let's say, and things suddenly came together in my imagination, I felt as if in some wonderful way my hands had been untied. It suddenly seemed to me that the classical modern short story, that marvel of gem-like compression that we get from Poe and Chekhov and Maupassant and company, and which becomes the one of the joys of American literature from the turn of the century on, that was finally, in a way I hadn't appreciated previously, a constrictive, even a constipative discipline, which, while I still admire, I felt suddenly marvelously freed from. I discovered the long novel. It's like a sprinter discovering the marathon, I suppose, and feeling that for a while that's the only race he wants to run. Combined with that was a move away from a kind of recognizable ordinary realism into the breathing space and freedom of fantasy, of the historical foretime, of myth. And while it doesn't take very much perception for a reader to see that a great many of the things that were preoccupying my imagination in those earlier, rather simpler novels continue to preoccupy it in the big, fat, complicated ones, and I hope you'll find when you read Sabbatical, continue to preoccupy it in what may be regarded as a kind of return, a guarded, hedged return, perhaps, to brevity, to relative simplicity, and to relative realism.
You said it gave you pleasure to look back at your early novels, The End of the Road and The Floating Opera, and indeed the critics still acclaim those novels. Many novelists look back as they mature at their original material and say, gee, did I write that? How could I have been so immature? You ever have those?
Let me quickly qualify my statement. Obviously, looking back at things you did 20 years ago, and God help us, 30 years ago, things you did in your 20s and your 30s, is like remembering who you were in your 20s and your 30s. And how you feel about that is going to depend very much, I suspect, on how you feel about yourself at the moment. So, of course, depending on your mood, you're likely to say, not bad for a kid, not bad for a brash 24-year-old who thinks he's inventing literature. Other times, of course, you clap your brow and say, oh, my God, how could I have written that sentence? But prevailingly, it seems to me that I'm no more embarrassed by the novels I wrote when I was 25 than I'm embarrassed by remembering the person that I was when I was 25.
Writers such as Mailer and Capote and Vidal are very colorful characters, and they make news even when they're not writing. But I have the feeling that John Barth is kind of a quiet, now I could be wrong because I have only met you today, but that John Barth is perceived as a kind of a quiet academic, unlikely to run into bar brawls or run for elective office, this sort of thing. Do you believe that a writer should subordinate himself to the kinds of notoriety that some of your colleagues have had?
I have no doubt whatsoever that the gentleman you just mentioned, many of whose works, let me say immediately, I admire, consider. I'm glad somebody's doing that kind of thing. I'm glad somebody's leading that kind of life. Let me say immediately that I don't doubt for a moment that their life is, in the area of events, a more interesting one than mine. I don't wish to lead that kind of life. Let me say again, second, that I feel very strongly that there's no correlation whatsoever, one way or the other, between the color and eventfulness of an author's life, or even the historical events that have him by the throat, or that he's had to suffer through, and the quality of his work. What I believe, we find, for example, that there are, on the one hand, writers like Byron, from whom all that Hemingway, Mailer kind of thing comes, I suppose, who did marvelous work while leading what at least looked to us from a distance as being, in some respects anyhow, marvelous lives. Then there are writers like Jane Austen and Franz Kafka, who seem to have led comparatively eventless lives, whose work is at least as marvelous in its very different way. Your first impressions are not deceiving. My own life is, thank God, so tranquil and relatively eventless in the sense of events that would make interesting fiction
What about...
I hope it stays that way.
What about a political role for writers? We know that Vidal is running for governor, is it? Governor?
Yes, senator. Senator from California.
And Robert Lowell, of course, in the 60s was passionately opposed to the Vietnam War. I would assume that writers have as much a role in society and in playing a political process as non-writers.
Certainly no less one.
Yeah. You, of course, play no political role.
No political role, and my books have been almost programmatically non-political until sabbatical, which for one reason or another, reasons I perhaps scarcely understand myself. The thread in the story of the CIA and of our covert operations in Chile and Iran and so forth runs through that story like a kind of contamination through my precious Chesapeake Bay. I could explore for myself the reasons why that crops up in the book, but I'm much less interested in why it's there than in the fact that it seemed to me at the time that was an essential element in the story.
Well,
I don't think, by the way, that Mr. Vidal's running for office or so forth is going to make his fiction any better or any worse. It takes only the briefest glance at the actual corpus of our literature to appreciate the fact that one writer will come to the medium with such a heroic resolve as Alexander Solzhenitsyn's, for example, the high moral purpose of trying to expose and undermine a tyrannical form of government. Another writer will come to the medium with what is unquestionably an absolutely effete and decadent urge, such as Flaubert's, to write a novel, as he says in a letter to his mistress of 1872, what I really wish I could do is write a novel about nothing. Now, no doubt Mr. Solzhenitsyn would retch at the idea of Mr. Flaubert coming to literature with that indefensible lack of moral purpose. No doubt Mr. Flaubert would simply tisk his Gallic tongue at the high-minded heroism with which Mr. Solzhenitsyn comes to the medium. But my private conviction, and it's a very deep one too, is that the muses are a much less responsible committee in the moral sphere than the Swedish Academy, who award the Nobel Prizes. I suspect in my heart of hearts that the muses decide to sing or not to sing on very different grounds from the quality of a writer's moral purpose, that there is no correlation one way or the other.
John Barth, sabbatical deals with a former CIA agent named Fenwick, I believe, and his wife, Susan. They have spent 9 months in a 33-foot sailboat going around the world, and the novel has them entering the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay heading up toward Baltimore. Can you, in a nutshell, tell our listeners how you were able to accomplish the improbable task of creating a joint narrator?
It's one of those things that one of those happy accidents that one realizes, at least that this one realizes, is right the first time. As you know, it's very hard to do anything new in literature. Literature is so old and so wide that almost everything has been done not only once but many times over. And a writer who, with some kind of tooth-clenched effort, tries to be original for the sake of being original is likely, in the first place, to come a cropper, and in the second place, to have somebody point out to him that this was done 3,000 years ago on such and such an Egyptian papyrus. But I really rather suspect that there is no precedent for this point of view. The point of view your listeners might be interested to hear is, as you described it, a kind of we, which is not the author, it's certainly not the famous editorial we, etc. It is the voice of these two people, a man and his wife. The book, by the way, is a love story in which the lovers happen to have been married to one another for 7 years already, who are coming back from a period of trying to accommodate to certain crises in their past life and face certain crises that they see impending in their life to come. At the same time, they're telling each other stories and trying to get their own story told. And while they speak of themselves as Fenwick, the male lead in the novel, and Susan, the female lead in the novel, whenever they're speaking together, it's the we. This is our story, they say. We speak of our cruise and so forth. I hope you found the point of view not confusing at all, but perfectly charming.
I got used to it, it took a little while, but then I began to figure it out. And I noticed that in sabbatical you throw in just about everything. There's, of course, there's spy intrigue. There's a detailed description of how Vietnamese music is made. There's a travelogue of the Chesapeake Bay and of Baltimore. Did you leave out anything that you wanted to include?
There's a famous, no doubt apocryphal story about Tolstoy. You may know that after finishing War and Peace, he wakes up one night from a nightmare crying, "A yacht race! A yacht race!" The point being, that's the only thing he forgot to put in War and Peace. I made very clear that there was a yacht race I made very sure that there was a yacht race in Sabbatical. The genre, or the literary form that I'm most at home in, is the novel. And I think of all the forms of literature, perhaps of all the forms of art in the world, the novel is the one which historically has been the most hospitable to contamination of every sort. It's the most impure form of literature, no doubt, ever imagined. God help the writer who doesn't relish that contamination. Where but in the novel can you throw in deliberately undigested lumps of journalism? For example, I'm thinking now of the accounts of the true story of the ex-CIA official, John Arthur Paisley, who either committed suicide or was killed from his sailboat in Chesapeake Bay, thereby not inspiring but occasioning this novel. Where else can you interpolate bars of music, whole stretches of play-like dialogue, headlines from papers, etc.? God bless the novel. God bless its impurities and contaminations.
On Crosstalk, this is Don Swaim talking with the author John Barth, and he's the author of Lost in the Funhouse, Chimera, and his new book, of course, is Sabbatical, which is what we're talking about. You include a very violent sex scene in Sabbatical, which is quite shocking. In fact, vivid sex seems to be almost obligatory for novels of the highest caliber these days. What's wrong with a good old-fashioned PG novel?
Nothing at all. I have a great affection for PG novels. We mentioned earlier in our conversation, it got mentioned, that Dickens remains one of my great heroes. He's one of the gods in my pantheon. And I'm as ill as the rest of us of sadistic sex in fiction and in other places. And yet, it seemed to me that since the essence of this story is that it is actually a quite idyllic, even pastoral romance between two serious, intelligent people, a man and a woman, husband and wife, who are married to each other, who love each other, who have certain problems but certain blisses, that kind of pastoral, if it isn't going to put a reader to sleep, ought to be played out against a number of kinds of realistic and non-idyllic, non-pastoral intrusions. The violence, this, I sound like a professor now and not a storyteller, but it seems to me to be perfectly plain that the deliberately savage violence of the multiple rape scene very near the beginning of this otherwise rather tranquil story is there precisely to show what kinds of shocks people who have any happiness and serenity in their lives at all live them out against. Clearly, it's the counterpart of other kinds of violence, the violence that our covert operations divisions of the CIA
still in including
work on other
scene.
People's governments, for example.
In including the scene, though, John Barth, you are going to lose a certain part of a potential audience, namely, say, a high school audience, because the book would probably not be included on a high school library show.
That's true, Don, and it's a bit of a pity. One wishes one could reach that audience. That's an important audience, and it would be a very naive and innocent writer indeed who didn't think twice before doing such a thing. I hope you'll agree with me that my novels are not given to that kind of thing, that this is a decision that one makes along with other kinds of decisions as a conscious artistic decision for which, you know, there is going to be a trade-off. Even the purest kind of literature involves one trade-off after another. This is followed not long after by that long, deliberately unassimilated lump of journalism that we mentioned a moment ago, the documents of the Paisley case. One knows when one does that one's going to lose a certain number of readers, in this case not the high school kids, but those people who say, "By golly, I like a straight story." And
we're also going to get in trouble with the moral majority.
You see me worrying about that.
Let me ask...
Just a moment, Don. It's important for me to say that the young woman who is the heroine of this novel, Susan Seckler, who's recounting the story of her sister's catastrophic multiple rapes, a story the details of which, of course, one borrows from the newspaper. There they are. You don't have to look very far to find that. At one point, her husband says to her, really what you're saying and what I say and what anybody says at that point. Why do we have to hear this? Isn't it enough to know that such dreadful things happen? Susan's reply is a reply that it's worth reminding readers and ordinary civilians any number of times, including those of us who tell stories, of, and that is that things like subversion, rape, revolution, torture, sadism, that these are just words, that it's the detail, it's in the details that the reality lies. I defy anyone to tell me that that was a salacious scene, but a violent scene. It certainly was.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about yourself. You were born a twin?
Yes, opposite sex twin. Opposite. That is to say, my sister is of the opposite sex from myself.
And that becomes very apparent in Sabbatical because both of the chief characters are twins as well.
Each one has a twin, which he or she has lost one way or another.
What role did being a twin have on your becoming a writer?
I don't know whether it had any role at all in my becoming a writer, though having become one for one reason or another, anyone finds that certain things from his or her past experience tend to, let's not say haunt, that's too dramatic a term, but tend to preoccupy the imagination. Another writer I know said once in an interview recently in the New York Times that if he remembers 40 years later a moment when he was 5 and broke his shoelace, then that fact must be terribly important, though, and he will use it in his fiction, though he himself may not know exactly what its importance is. As a storyteller, it doesn't matter to me why twins haunt my fiction or what the relation is. It's only as a lay psychoanalyst, let's say, that I might explore the reason. It might be said, however, that twins have the curious experience, as I remarked somewhere in print. It's not a thing. I don't talk about my life a great deal in print, but every now and then these things crop up. Twins of any sort, opposite sex, same sex, identical, fraternal, share the curious experience of having been with a companion from the beginning, of feeling inevitably whether their parents make much of their twinship, mine didn't, or make little of their twinship, of feeling inevitably somehow that they are only part of a person, that the other part of their identity is somewhere else. Now, we don't have to go very far into the mythologies of various civilizations, including our own, to find that that image, the idea that we are somehow less complete than we used to be, is an image that haunts the imagination of various religions, of various myths, of most cultures. And for most writers, it becomes a metaphor. It becomes a metaphor for any kind of dualism, good versus evil, mortality versus immortality, what have you. In some writers, it becomes Mark Twain, for example, and running right through classical American literature, take Mark Twain's name famously, you know, the idea of the person divided into twain. Twinship becomes an image of the divided self or the inner adversary, or as Joseph Conrad puts it in his wonderful title, the secret sharer. But a curious thing about being a literal twin is that you can turn this around. You know, I've always suspected that I could use something like the divided personality, the clinically divided personality, or what have you, as a metaphor for what I know to be the case. That is, having shared an identity at one time.
John Barth, because of our time constraints,
don't get me going on Twitter.
What was it like growing up in the 1930s and 40s in the Eastern Shore community of Cambridge, Maryland, which in the 60s saw much racial violence? Did you experience any of that or witness any racial problems when you were growing up in Cambridge?
By no means. One didn't witness the racial problems for the unpleasant reason that segregation was so pure and complete that one never had a chance to meet acquaintances and peers from the other race. And so one grew up down there in a kind of aura of benign goodwill, which only later on you realize was founded on a great deal of ignorance and systematic suppression by extremely good-natured people who, however, you know, were themselves the victims of history. I had the experience of going to Europe and living for a while just before all hell broke loose in my hometown on the racial question. And coming back to this town, which I had loved, where my father had a restaurant, etc. His name was Whitey, and he had a restaurant on Race Street. How do you like that? And finding suddenly that my benign, quiet little hometown was in the national news because it was riven by a racial violence, which was long overdue as soon as one became alive to the causes which had been simmering there for a long time, which baffled the good white folks of the community.
You, of course, you left the Eastern Shore. You spent some 20 years in the North as a professor, and you're back in Baltimore, which has a great literary tradition, the tradition of Fitzgerald and Poe and Mencken.
When you say Fitzgerald and Poe, you remind me that writers have had a hard time in Baltimore historically. It's not that way now.
I believe even in sabbatical there is a visit to Poe's grave, isn't there?
Indeed, when I describe, or the writer of the flap copy on the back jacket of Sabbatical describes the leading lady, Susan Seckler, as being part Jewish, part gypsy, and possibly descended from Edgar Allan Poe, that immediately sounds to me like a description of American literature, part Jewish, part gypsy, and possibly descended from Edgar Allan Poe.
What's it like living and working in Baltimore?
Well, we have a quiet literary community. The novelist Ann Tyler lives a few blocks away from me, quietly doing her work, while I, a few blocks away from her, quietly do mine. We have a community of poets and writers, many of whom have come through the Johns Hopkins writing seminars, which I help preside over, and then hang around reading each other's poetry and fiction and what have you. It's a charming city.
Tell me about your students. Since you are a professor of creative writing, you deal with the younger generation. What kind of people are they?
Hotshots. Let me say that I am unashamedly, unabashedly a teacher as well as a writer. And I have nothing but contempt for those who have nothing but contempt for the idea of writers working in universities. It's one of the least abusive ways a writer can spend his life, I think, and get his work done, unless he needs to be in the very thick of things, like a Hemingway, etc. So be it, if that's the case. It gives me the chance to deal with some young people whom I know are going to be among the interesting American fiction writers of the next generation. And that's lively. They take me aside quietly and tell me what I should be reading, and I go read it. I take them aside quietly and try to coach them in how to tell stories better, which, by the way, is the last thing a talented young apprentice writer learns. The first thing they have is a way with language. The second thing they have, if they're apprentice writers and not, fiction writers and not apprentice poets, is a kind of knack for character, a flair for the telling detail that can move the story along. But the last thing they learn is the oldest and first ingredient of storytelling, and that's how to keep the thing suspenseful, keep the reader wanting, or the listener wondering, what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next, and then not losing one single thread in the Argyle sock of their plot on the last page.
There is this fear, however, that young people today are becoming less literate as we have more and more of audiovisual technology exploding around us. Do you find that to be the case?
What I find among my good students is that they certainly are much more shaky in matters of grammar, syntax, and punctuation than their daddies and mommies and their granddaddies and grandmommies were. I like to remember, just to console myself, that the great ages of literature have not always been, like the Elizabethan period, for example, have not always been the great ages of correct spelling and punctuation. That's one thing. But on the other hand, there is that, I think, undeniable fact that the other great media of narrative, television and films, lead young people, even those with a fondness for narrative, into reading fewer sentences by the time they reach, say, age 18, than their parents and their grandparents. And God knows that's how they learn to write.
I must bring this discussion to a close. Unfortunately, our time is out. With me on Crosstalk, John Barth, who won the National Book Award for Chimera and whose latest book is Sabbatical, published by Putnam. I'm Don Swing.